Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to season 3 of Old Millennials.
Woo!
Yay! We are a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. And today, I am your host, Emily.
And tomorrow, I'll be your host, Margo.
Today.
I'm just yes-anding what you started.
I appreciate that. Though you write in sketch, you had the heart of an improv.
Mm-hmm, yes, that's what they say. Brain of a sketch writer, heart of an improv performer.
Someone better be making that print on Etsy within 24 hours from now. Today, we are talking about a very important topic from the early 2000s. In fact, from the year 2000, we will be talking about Y2K, the crazy phenomenon that had the world thinking doomsday was upon us come January 1st, 2000.
I mean, not to get too like, well, on back in my day, but this has a lot in going through a little bit of history and mostly pop culture, since that's my segment. It's really interesting to note the parallels between the paranoia of 2019 going into 2020 versus 1999 going into 2000. And I mean, you're going to talk about it later, but there is a computer bug relation between the 20 years anyway, which makes it all the more eerie and time is a flat circle kind of situation.
For sure. The more things change, the more they stay to same, and like no shortage of that with this whole ordeal. I mean, I remember it being just every single local news or even national news was just talking about what was happening. You know, will we be ready? Do people have the food and supplies they need? I mean, this was like, I don't think in my knowledge or conscious, I guess, as a human, that was the first time I remember people really thinking about, you know, the end is nigh, because this is pre 9/11. This is pre terrorism. Like, there's just the 90s in relation to what we've experienced since are so tame in comparison.
They're extremely quaint. I do feel like preppers, doomsday preppers, were the precursor to hoarders.
For sure.
And it is interesting how much of the groundwork was laid in 1999 and 2000 to set the tone for the last 20 years. So many things that came true and so many things that like stayed, like you said, exactly the same. But it is quite quaint to look back on what people thought, or at least because Time magazine seemed to have a much more prominent place in people's lives than it does now, because print is dead, etc. But it is interesting how many points of cultural reference are like, oh, because it was a Time magazine cover. I'll talk about it a little bit later, but ravers had a whole Time magazine cover and it was like a big deal, and that's how we knew that rave culture was like a big part of the early 2000s.
It is kind of crazy to think that there were, and they still exist, but like you said, we don't really read Time, or people don't subscribe to Time the way they did 20 years ago.
And the Time, like most 100 influential people of the year or whatever, the thing that people look out for the most is the red carpet tree that happens.
Exactly.
And not so much like the list itself.
For sure. And I feel like what's crazy, though, is that Time, once upon a time, for lack of a better word, was very much the weekly stories were not just about politics or international affairs or what have you, or technology, but really talking about pop culture and the phenomenon around, you know, various movements that were taking place at the time.
I feel like the tone of Time at that time in space.
Didn't subscribe to space.
Wow. Yeah, it did. That came out weird. A lot of it also felt a little bit like Dateline-y meets Sports Talk with Bryant Gumbel. Like,
oh, yeah.
That sort of news journal tone that was like so prevalent of like Barbara Walters and This Is 2020, which is kind of funny now because that was that gift that went around after it became actual 2020 this year. It was just, I'm Barbara Walters and This Is 2020.
I did appreciate Sherry O'Terry coming on to the New Year's special with Anderson Cooper and just like putting him in stitches with her impression and the way she talked. Like, it was brilliant. I was just happy to see Sherry O'Terry was alive and well.
Talk about a deranged New Year's countdown program. Every year, it never fails to be as strange as it can be. There was one year where I came home after a night of going out, and it was Wolf Blitzen right?
A wolf blitzer.
Blitzer, not Blitzen, which is a reindeer.
That would be adorable, though.
But he was reading Demi Lovato's Sorry Not Sorry lyrics, but like a spoken word poem. And although I'd had something to drink, I was like, I really cannot process what it is that I'm watching. And I just, every year the show just descends into another level of madness.
I mean, yeah, the people who make appearances now, I mean, it's, I think it's the closest we get to a 1960s variety special in terms of who just shows up to make an appearance.
Yeah, sometimes it's Mariah Carey, sometimes it's Chrissy Teigen getting assaulted by an umbrella. You know, it really runs the gamut.
That it does, that it does. So to go a little bit into Y2K, I'm going to go into the history of it all. Y2K is a shorthand way of writing the year 2000, which was otherwise known as the Millennium Bug. It had a bunch of other names at certain points, CDC or Century Date Change, FADL, which was faulty data, or excuse me, faulty date logic.
But what a sexy name.
Very sexy name. And people had known about Y2K, or whatever you want to call it, for years. The name was actually first coined in June of 1995. There was a guy by the name of David Eddy, who was a programmer, who in an email within a forum gave it the name Y2K, and that stuck over time.
And this is in regards to like a tech name, right?
Right.
Not in regards to anything else.
Correct, correct. And so what happened was, ultimately, we had known about this issue for 20, 30, 40, even in the 60s when these things were being coded in, people knew about this issue. They couldn't see the level of impact it could one day have, but they at least knew, yeah, this could potentially be something, but let's sweep it under the rug. Like, there's one guy in an interview I was reading who had brought it up at IBM in the late 70s and was like, this might be an issue, and brought this up to his supervisor. And the guy was just like, you know what? It's going to cost too much money. Let's just like hope that from 20 years from now, there's something we've figured out. And that's the common thread with Y2K. As I was doing this research, there was just a whole lot of what is the cheapest, fastest way we can fix something without having to override software, overriding hardware. And it was this huge, it ended up being a much bigger problem as a result of that. So to give you a little overview of what this bug meant was, essentially, when people started coding dates into computers in the 60s and 70s, they did it with a two-digit date, two-digit month, two-digit year format. And the thought process was, once upon a time, you probably remember this growing up, your family computer did not have much memory. Memory was very expensive, and it was even worse in the 60s and 70s.
I mean, how much could a floppy disk even hold? I think someone translated it, and it's like, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
It's like a 30-second song file today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You could, your old iPod could hold more stuff in it than an old floppy disk, which is why your parents and yourself, if you went to elementary school at a certain time, you had tons of these floppy disks that were completely useless.
Everywhere. I remember carrying them in my backpack in high school so I could print something out or finish something up if I needed
to. But you had to number them because they could hold so little in there.
So little.
You had to spread it across three or four of these little stupid floppy disks, and then you would lose track of which one was which when you had to go print something out.
And then you might override something accidentally, and that was just like a hot mess. It was a very different time. And so as a shortcut, these developers and programmers way back when were like, we're going to keep this to a two-date, two-month, two-year format instead of 4 years, four-digit years, with the thought of, this is 1960 whatever, this is 1970 whatever, 20, 30, 40 years from now, we'll figure it out. And then nothing really happened. So over time, you know, discussions came up, and even in the early 90s, before the Y2K craze, there was an article in like Computer World magazine that brought up this conundrum. But it ended up becoming a bigger and bigger risk or problem that got national and international attention around 1995 and 1996.
Whoops-a-daisy.
Yeah.
So much of this truly sounds like what happened with Bart. It's like a microcosm, obviously,
yeah.
But it's like we never thought we'd ever get to this point. Or even more micro than that, I was in disbelief when I started high school. I was like, I never really thought about getting to high school. It was like so far in the future growing up that I never considered the reality of what it would be like.
Right. And it's interesting. Metro was built very similarly as BART. I think they thought of it as just like a commuter rail to bring people in from the other
in D.C.?
Parts. Yeah. Metro, sorry, yeah, to give you, yeah, Metro is the DC version of BART.
But there's also the LA Metro, that's why I was like, wait,
what? Right, yeah, but it's just, a lot of these were built, with the exception of the subway and a cup, you know, and around the world, you go to Paris and other countries.
Well, you don't ever wait longer than five minutes for a subway, because it is actually built to transport people as a way of needed transportation.
Right.
Like you said, DC and also the Bay Area BART, it's built as a commuter train, and they never really thought this many people would depend on it every single day. So they've seen upwards, especially in the last 6 to 8 years during this tech boom, they've seen an increase of like 1,000% every single year.
The same thing happened in DC. And it's fascinating to me, because I think we were so tied to cars 20, 30, 40 years ago and anywhere outside of a really, really big city like a New York or Paris. But it's funny, like we were so car driven for so long that no one thought that, especially our generation, would make that shift into wanting to live near public transportation, use that not just for work and commute, but also for your day-to-day life, to run errands and to go to things, to hang out with friends. But yeah, I mean, it was a very similar thing with Y2K.
Or that having a car also in a big city was becoming not a completely tenable situation.
It just got more and more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems that people started predicting as a result of all the glitches that could come out of Y2K were thinking like something as like ATM would stop working, the electrical grid, so all of our power would just cease to work on January 1st, and that you would have the, you know, system that was running, controlling air traffic would just fall apart, and it could result in all sorts of crashes.
Oh, yeah, there were so many people that were like, I'm not going to fly on the 31st or the 1st.
And this is 2000, which was, back then, a fraction of our lives ran on computers. Like, I think I can safely say that 20 years later, there are twice as many, three times as many, however many you want to say, things run using computers. But even back then, like, it's easy to forget just how many things of our logistics and how we live our life are tied to computers.
A common thing I kept coming across was that the reason why there was so much tech phobia during this time was that computers were enough a part of our daily lives that we were becoming somewhat dependent on them. But on the other hand, we didn't quite know enough about them yet to predict what they were going to do.
Right. I mean, they really only it covered like a fraction of our day-to-day lives. Like, you did your work on it, or your homework, or your actual work, adult work, or you used it for research, or you might have used it for maybe keeping the books or something. But it wasn't like day-to-day, anything. You use a computer or your phone, which is a computer, to just look up something.
Which is, I mean, our phone today is obviously much more dangerous than a computer from 1999.
Exactly.
It's very much like the net depicted, truly, up until recently.
Until very recently, you're absolutely right. So some of the other things that they worried about was, like, even things like documentation. So there was a Reddit post that one of the articles I read linked to about this guy who was born on January 1st, 2000. And because wherever he was born, I think it was like Indiana, they hadn't updated for the Y2K bug. The date it was issued was like February 1st, 1900 or something like that. And so you ended up with people who, you know, were documentation would be set to 1900, or someone had like a mortgage payment and, you know, it's being calculated on a yearly basis. So clock strikes 12, it's going to start calculating things beginning 1900, and all of a sudden you have like a 130-year mortgage versus a 30-year mortgage rate. So just insanity like this that we, you know, couldn't have predicted, or people kind of thought about, you know, when they first started programming computers, but nowhere near at that time could people predict just how much, even in 1999, computers would be a part of our lives. So at that point, people start freaking out. Articles start getting published, like the Time magazine, where it's very kind of doomsday-esque. And people start thinking, like, what are we supposed to do? And so from a government perspective, there's intervention. From a corporate perspective, people start setting up task forces, like at IBM in, like, 1995. They were already putting together engineering teams that were going to solve the Y2K problem. And the severity of this issue was so insane that Bill Clinton in 1998 made a commitment to what the government could do to solve the problem. And he appointed a Y2K czar whose name is John Koskinen. And I know this name because I was a consultant for the IRS for 5 years. And later down the line, Obama appointed John Koskinen to be chairman of the IRS. So when I, or sorry, commissioner of the IRS. And I actually shared an elevator with him one time and didn't realize that was him until 2 seconds later when he left the elevator with a person who was next to him who was, in fact, his security detail. I digress.
DC brushes with fame.
I mean, this is literally all I get to hang my head on.
XOXO Gossip Girl.
I get to see an occasional senator when I'm back home. It's very exciting for me. Very different background than growing up in Burbank. So the panic for this all was insane. Time magazine, obviously, like I said, published these kind of doomsday-esque articles. Bill Clinton even said at one point, this is not one of those summer movies where you can close your eyes during the scary parts.
What? So,
what kind of quote is that? He had made this out to be some sort of, like, horror film disaster movie.
Whoa,
like,
way to fucking stoke the flames, Billy. So, Jesus.
Naturally, people were so freaked out that some of them went into preparedness mode. So, went into survivalist, what have you mode. So, in a poll by USA Today and the National Science Foundation, at one point, 40% of the respondents in this survey plan to stockpile food and water. That is bonkers, but, like, you forget that at that time, we just had no idea. And it's so much so that this guy named Ed Yurden, who is a computer consultant and author of he was a prominent person in the Y2K movement and wrote a
movement?
Book, the movement to learn about it and solve it and what have you.
Oh, okay, not like a doomsday, all gonna end.
But he kind of went in that direction. So he moved his family from New York City to rural New Mexico because he was so afraid of what would happen in New York if the grids went down and there was, you know, chaos ensued. And there were lists, like you had CNN who would publish a list about what to get in what the Red Cross recommended. It wasn't like the Red Cross guidelines for Y2K, but their disaster guidelines. So CNN recommended you get a bunch of canned vegetables, high energy foods, bottled water, aspirin, syrup or Ipecac to induce vomiting. Wow. Laxatives, thermometer.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Cash, a whistle, disposable plates and utensils, battery-operated radio. Basically, a lot of what you get, traveler's checks. Well, that's 1990s.
I mean, honestly, this is so much of the stuff that, being somebody who grew up in California, exactly, wasn't an earthquake preparedness kit.
Exactly. It was very much of that nature. Like, it was all the same things that you would normally carry in a disaster type of preparedness kit. And when this all went down, of course, naturally, the U.S. government had to fix everything on their computers, on their side. But it's also on the corporate side. They estimated that it ended up costing large businesses in the United States alone collectively $100 billion to fix the Y2K bug. And in fact, the Commerce Secretary at the time, William Daley, noted that the Y2K price tag worked out to $365 for every American citizen to fix the Y2K bug. And at that time, you had kind of two solutions to fix this. You had your short term, which you could adopt, which was kind of a quick fix called windowing, which would treat all dates from 00 to 20. So it would kind of get you all the way to 2020, which we'll talk about more later, but wouldn't require the same level of infrastructure change and renovation and, like, redoing code, maybe even having to buy new hardware, that the full fix would have to do. And so a lot of companies ended up going with that quick fix. In fact, at the time, they estimated 80% of computers fixed in 1999 used that quicker, cheaper option. And over time, most of those computers eventually got a fix in to help with that as technology got better. But as we'll see later on in this, there were people who never made those fixes happen. And on January 1st, 2020, people ran into issues. So a little more on the history here. It was as people were making all these changes, people were ensuring that we wouldn't be affected. John Koskinen, the guy who had been appointed by Bill Clinton, was so confident that there weren't going to be any issues after all the work that they had put in there, that he boarded a plane on New Year's Eve, like right before the clock struck 12, so that he would be up in the air to show that he was, quote unquote, like risking his life.
Risking it all to prove a point.
To prove a point.
We love Petty.
We love Petty indeed. What I mean, and what's crazy is we didn't hear just about, we heard a lot about what the government steps were taking in some of the major companies, but there were a lot of companies at the time that kept pretty quiet about what they were doing in the back end to fix this. There was one guy in this Time article I read, he talked about, he was a former IT head of a grocery store chain, and he said that all of the research and work that they put into fixing this issue was kept as secretive as possible because they were so afraid of the PR nightmare that would ensue if people found out that they were working on this. Because there were so many companies that tried to keep quiet about working on it because they were so worried of what their reputation, what that would do to their reputation if people found out they had glitches in their system. And this is before we had credit card identities compromised all the time. Like now I feel like...
Oh, like giant Target leaks and stuff like that.
Every year I feel like every major... there is a major company or two that has a major data breach with our info. Back then, this was like such new territory because computers were still relatively new that any sort of kind of insecurity would really lead to what people worried kind of pandemonium and lack of business for their business.
And now no one even flinches anymore.
Right, exactly. You're like, oh shit, Target... like I had another data breach again. Guess I got to go in and like, you know, do but whatever.
So many people also now have identity protection that exactly. come with their credit cards and so on and so forth. And that it's just, again, it's like a completely new world and is maybe getting closer to the total recall dystopia
for sure.
that we all feared. But I don't know. It's just interesting that this was like what they thought was a concern.
And now.
And a PR nightmare.
Well, it's so funny because now, you know, we talk about like cybersecurity and all this stuff. Like people, there are, you know, a lot of people who believe, you know, this is before 9/11. This is before anthrax. This is before like the, we were talking about the DC sniper before the, we started recording because I'm listening to a podcast about it. It's before all of that happened. And so, you know, at the time, the idea of cybersecurity and needing to protect from attacks and that kind of thing was such a off the radar, like no one was even thinking about it, that you know in the 10 years that followed after everything that took place, there became such a huge market for cybersecurity and data protection and all that, that we, you know, even when things like this happen now, like you were saying, we don't worry too much because there are all the precautions put in place to ensure that it doesn't ruin your life.
Right.
A couple of funny things that I read from an AP article in February of 2000 that talked about the results of those folks who did not do anything with their computer systems to prepare. There was a video store in upstate New York that tried to charge a customer $91,250 because the computer thought the rented movie he had returned was 100 years late.
I also have that in my little intro as well. I thought that that was the funniest thing, that that was the worst that could have happened. And it's a John Travolta movie, of all things.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to read it because it's already written down, yeah, but course. Yes.
Yeah, and those, I mean, I have a couple of other examples, but I think you'll probably touch upon them.
So I was tasked with the pop culture temperature at the time, and it was the dawn of a new millennium, or Will Ellium, if you're Will Smith in late 1999. Pop culture around this time was a mix of a gimmicky cash-in, like Will2K, tech phobia, because as I talked about earlier, computers were normalized just enough to be a part of people's everyday lives, but not trusted that much, and also just a dash of blind optimism for the future, like, are we one step closer to getting a flying car? The answer is still fucking no.
No.
But as Emily had mentioned multiple times, this was pre-9/11, pre-anthrax, pre-dot-com housing crash. It was, again, a time for blind optimism. We had yet to experience George W. Bush, we had already had the first one already. So it was quite interesting to look back and see what some of the pop culture touchstones were. And the most famous of them all was a Time magazine cover back when Time was actually much more relevant and something that you could look to as a marker of what the world felt like, or at least obviously North America was going through. And so the cover stoked the fears of what would befall humanity when we went from 99 to 2000. It was a drawing of Jesus as the world is ending. His back is to us, but we can read the sandwich board that he wears. It says, end of the world? And then a subheader, dot, 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 millennium madness. In retrospect, the fear of a computer uprising kickstarting the end of the world seems hilariously overblown. Best Buy had, like, this whole ad campaign around how you must turn your computer off at midnight on December 31st, 1999, or else, upside down question marks, we never really knew. But your computer needed to be off. I remember that was a thing my mom was very adamant about. She didn't get, like, too freaked out about anything other than just make sure the computer's off before you go to bed. I remember how TV anchors were earnestly telling anxious people that ATMs would be spewing their money out yep. of their hard-earned bank accounts on January 1st, 2000. Turns out the worst thing that happened was a customer in New York, a video rental store, received a bill for $91,000, the cost of returning a John Travolta film, The General's Daughter, for 100 years.
Oh, wow.
So much of this time period accurately predicted the future, like right now, 2020, and reflected the time that we were living in 1999. There's a reason why there's been a reemergence of early 2000s fashion recently. We're in a similar time of anxious optimism that marked the Y2K era so distinctly. We are staring at the arrival of the future. So in 1999, going into 2000, which was like the kind of Y2K pop culture time that I looked at, I kind of split it up into a couple little subdivisions. So we're going to start with tech and style. The iMac G3 was the beginning of Apple's dominance in the yeah. tech aesthetic department. If you didn't have a colorful iMac G3, you weren't shit, especially in middle school.
I wanted one so badly, but I came from a PC family.
I also did not get one. I actually didn't even get a Mac, I don't think, until college.
Me, yeah, same.
It was always, dude, you're getting a fucking Dell and it sucks.
Yeah. Oh, that was around the same time, too. Steve from Dell.
But my best friend Marianne did have an iMac in a lime green color, I believe. And so we definitely used Napster to download a bunch of rap onto it throughout middle school and high school. So I got a little taste, you know. Similar to Apple iMacs, Nokia cell phones, especially the ones where you could change out the colors, were huge.
Oh, right.
They were smaller, they were faster, and they had the snake game on them, which, you know, who didn't fucking love that?
I just saw a really interesting documentary that was on, I think the BBC produced, on Nokia. They're a company out of Finland, and they, like, went from nothing to being the number one cell phone provider for, like, 15 years, and then the iPhone happened, and it, like, all went to shit. But everyone had that brick.
But
everyone.
They still make other stuff, too.
They do, but their market, or their hold on a market, like, went from
100% to 0%
exactly,
overnight.
Like that.
And I completely agree. They are a brick because I think that the aesthetic is the 80s idea of a cell phone of the future is what Nokia cell phones
look
like.
For sure, for sure.
Rave culture was also extremely popular, so much so that it was featured on a Time cover talking about the pervasiveness of E and the long-term effects that it may or may not have.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a real after-school special vibe, but between Moby and Jenko jeans, it was hard to deny that rave culture didn't have a lasting effect on this time period.
It even got its own movie. Remember the movie Go?
Oh, right. Yeah, that movie's insane. And then I think about Prodigy as well, which also was like rave culture. That Prodigy was like big in what started like the warehouse circuit, but then by the early 2000s, everybody had moved out of warehouses, and it was more like after-hours clubs where you wear giant Doc Marten boots too.
Yep.
Motorola predicted the rise of the digital personal assistants like Siri and Google Home with their version called Maya. Maya was pitched as a quote-unquote cyber babe, which gross cringe, who could quote-unquote read the internet to you. The commercial, which initially had its debut at during the 2000 Oscars, depicted regulars and Hugh Hefner alike calling Maya and saying shit like, Maya, read me the stocks, and Maya, what time is cops?
Wow. What a sentence from the 90s.
Yeah, and of course Hugh Hefner had like two blonde ladies and he was in the back of a limo screaming, Maya, read me the stocks. To really make it feel like full circle, or time is a flat circle depending on if you're a glass half empty, glass half full kind of person, the dot-com boom was also huge at this time, like it is now. It contributed to the paranoia of a robot uprising, again, like now, except now we're more focused on like AI and like how sentient that's going to become, and having a Google Home or having a Siri, like something that like tracks all of what you do all of the time, how that informs ads you get served. It's like a whole different hellscape.
For sure.
That 1999 wishes they fucking knew ahead of time.
When we went to Disneyland as a kid, do you remember the ride, the Carousel of Progress? It's like the one in Tomorrowland. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was one of the animatronic ones.
It doesn't exist anymore, but I know what you're talking about.
Well, so I remember going on that one at Disney World when I was...
I think it's that Buzz Lightyear ride now.
So when I was, I think I remember getting on it when I was like 9, because I think that's the year we went to Disney World. And I remember distinctly their version of the future had like voice operated or voice activated microwaves and stuff. And it was like half what we'd have now. And then like video screens to talk to people. And then it was like half like this is still not even close to happening in 2020. It's so funny, like when we were, you know, in the, making these things in the 80s and 90s and our idea of what the future would look like and how different and similar they are in some ways.
Yeah, we have a whole new, different, unimaginable set of horrors that we have to deal with now that we would have never predicted. And yet things that we really, really wanted, like flying cars or real hoverboards or, I don't know, a zero emission carbon cars, we don't really get any of that kind of stuff. But anyway, I think you can, to going back to the dot-com boom, especially with the Super Bowl coming up, I can think of a bunch of apps that had multi-million dollar ad campaigns run during like a Super Bowl that do not exist anymore. And the same can be said about what was happening 20 years ago. I'm going to have an honorable mention to Sony right now. They continue to innovate the Walkman and portable CD players with things like the mini disc. They also released the long-awaited follow-up to the PS1, the PS2, in March of 2000. And they made that weird robot dog that they got celebs like Britney Spears to pose with.
Remember
that?
Yeah.
I forgot to write down what that robot dog was called.
What was the point of it?
I don't really know. I feel like it was for people. It was before we started breeding hypoallergenic dogs, I think. And they're like, yeah, cool, like a robot dog.
It was step up from like a Gigapet or like a Tamagotchi. Sure.
But a part of me also feels like it had this like Venice boardwalk kind of vibe. Like, you know, people that sell kitschy shit along a touristy area and they always have like a little fake robot dog that's like pretending to sleep in a bed or something.
Right. And it's like being sold next to like a bunch of glow sticks and flashing swords and what have you.
Yeah, or even like those like fake out snakes.
Yeah, God.
Yeah, I don't really understand what the point was, but it was one of those things where we're like, damn, look at that technology. If we can have a robot dog, we're definitely that much closer to getting that robot made from the Jetsons. That's what I assume.
I feel like Janet Jackson had a music video for the song from the Nutty Professor movie around that time that featured one of those dogs.
I'm pretty sure because, I mean, I'm going to go into music soon, but I touch on Hype Williams.
Oh, yeah.
So, talking about music, what a perfect segue into my own next bullet point. What was 1999's highest selling album called? What else? Millennium.
Yes.
The Backstreet Boys' third album hit its peak of boy band boom on the precipice of Napster. They sold 1.1 million copies pure in its first week of release. It opens with the song Larger Than Life, and the music video that accompanies it has a clock that's ticking down to midnight on January 1st. You think it's going to be 2000, but fucking swerve, bitch, it's the year 3000. Nick Carter's a transformer. Howie's falling asleep each night in a cryogenic chamber. Brian Luttrell is skating around on a hoverboard like he's Channing Tatum from Jupiter Ascending.
Wow.
Yeah,
the movie that he and Mila Kunis would like us to never remember they made.
I'm sorry. No one's going to ever forget Dog Robot Space Boots. Pew! Burk! 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 I mean, I talk about the Wachowskis, too. They truly have an eye to the future and a pulse on the culture that we don't give them enough credit for.
I'll give them that.
Into my next point, someone who actually dictated the aesthetic of music videos for a really fucking long time, Hype Williams, his vision of the future was expressed through music videos for Janet Jackson, Busta Rhymes, Missy Elliott, and a bunch of other people who are featured on I'm Making the Music Video MTV Special. He was really the style guide for music videos from 1999 until record labels stopped giving artists million-dollar budgets for music videos, so like maybe 8 years ago. I can tell you from experience that even when I was in film school, Hype Williams' aesthetic of like a fisheye lens plus exaggerated gels on lights was extremely popular for everything from music videos to short films to anybody who said that Belly was in their top 10 favorite movies of all time. And trust me, there were quite a few people that said that in class.
I wonder how much that's held up in like a decade or two later.
If Hype Williams defined the look of Y2K, the sound of Y2K was defined by TLC's fan mail. I don't make the rules. Like, the whole album is extremely futuristic. They kind of predicted they predicted voice altering. Well, what the fuck does T-Pain use?
It's auto-tune.
Thank you. They predicted auto-tune with the song Silly Ho, which is like a strange sentence for me to be saying out loud, but if you listen to it, the whole rap is basically through this voice-altering sound mechanism, and yeah. It was before anybody like T-Pain or Akon was using it all the time to kind of make a joke about rap in some ways.
I feel like Cher was also a big pioneer because Believe uses that as well.
Right, and that was around the exact same time. Yep. And whether or not you love Cher, Cher also had a Cherissance yes. around this time and sort of redefined, especially club dance music, which also feeds into the trend of rave culture.
Yep.
She sort of like had a ripple effect over both kind of crossovers because they share so much music and kind of similar audiences. But in addition to TLC's fan mail defining the sound of the late, well, of the early 2000s, really, Lisa Left Eye Lopez was the first to fully embrace the I'm from the future kind of style, like way before The Matrix. And speaking of, we're going into movies, which is a great segue into my next point.
We're both dodging bullets in slow motion right now.
The Matrix. As much as I love Bring It On, no movie better defines the year 2000 than The Matrix. Some combination of like trench coats, rave culture, and a modern look on parallel realities that still permeates Reddit threads as we speak.
Yes.
Makes it have this sort of long-lasting effect. I feel like it does really hold up, especially for a sci-fi movie, even from a cinematography standpoint. The Wachowskis really did do a lot of groundbreaking stuff just in the first Matrix alone. Was it diminishing returns with each Matrix? Yeah, sure, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the first Matrix, which I think tops a lot of decade, 20-year-long lists as well, because it really, the style and its influence really carries over and has influenced a lot of directors who have come up since then.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And what's interesting is, like, I think it even lends itself to being a better film with its context of its release. Like, it's already a great film standalone, but I think when you see that it was released, and I believe it's like March, April of 1999, right before 2000, like, that's where it really lends itself to being like, oh my god, this makes even more sense. Like, just anyway, I'm a big fan of that movie.
Yeah, we're all in a simulation, yada yada. And I think, you know, that joke kind of comes up a lot more now especially. But I think between The Matrix and Idiocracy, like, it really feels like, oh my god, these movies were ahead of their time. Even though Idiocracy is what, like 2003?
Yeah.
But I kind of hold the two in the same kind of category. But in terms of pop culture, that is all that I have. I know that we were going to do history, pop culture, and personal anecdote.
Yeah, I mean, I think my one thing that I would bring up is kind of the last thing for me around the Y2K and the history is that ultimately, you know, apart from the $90,000 video charge and, you know, one or two things where, like, birth certificates had the wrong year and apparently Al Gore's campaign website at the time had the year listed as 19,100 when the clock struck 12.
Not on Al Gore's internet.
Not on Al Gore's internet. It really betrayed him that night. But ultimately, all these programmers spent hours and hours coding to make sure that this wouldn't, you know, screw everything up. And ultimately, we'll never know the impact of what could have happened just because things were fixed before that could ever take place. But I was reading a retrospect from people who had been the ones kind of developing the code at the time. And apparently, you know, these people were spending months, years, hours, you know, overtime developing the solution for this. And ultimately, this guy was one of the programmers, recalls that the reward he got for the 5-year project was lunch and a pen. Ultimately for Yikes. potentially saving the world.
Here's a pen. Was it like a Mont Blanc pen, at least? Like a nice pen?
No mention of the
It's not
sort.
Like a, it's like a clicky Bic pen.
It was probably someone's dry cleaner's pen.
Come to Chirpy's dry cleaning or whatever. Evergreen dry cleaning. Well, my personal anecdote is literally personal. Y2K was the first time I was actually able to have, like, an adult New Year's Eve experience, which was just a slumber party with my best friend Cassandra. But we rented a bunch of movies, and we were going to, like, stay up all night and watch all of them. So we started out with Can't Hardly Wait, which was my it immediately became my favorite movie as soon as we watched it. Mm. And this was, of course, the time that I was incredibly obsessed with all things MTV because I was boy band crazy and I loved TRL and I always rushed home after school to watch it to make sure that all of the correct music videos were making the top 10 naturally. But that year, MTV had a New Year's Eve show. After we watched Can't Hardly Wait, at midnight, No Doubt performed a cover of R.E.M.'s 1987 hit that I fucking despise, It's the End of the World as We Know It.
Right. I forgot about that.
Gwen Stefani had braces, but...
Yep.
And I love No Doubt, so we watched that, and then we went to sleep. But I remember it being like, oh, wow, like, this is what it's like to stay up till midnight, because up until that point, I was never up past midnight.
Yeah.
So it was, that was the year it all changed.
That was like Return of Saturn era too.
Yeah, she had the pink hair and like the Bantu buns on top.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, and then she would go on to get engaged to Gavin Rosdale.
Aww.
Which we should definitely cover in an upcoming episode called Iconic Couplings.
Oh, for sure, for sure. So I don't really have any personal anecdotes from Y2K. I, too, remember watching that MTV special at a friend's house where we had a sleepover.
Sleepover is really popular in 1999.
Yeah, for sure, especially given our ages. And the other thing I remember is my dad at the time had bought, like, a kind of tabletop wok hot pot situation at the Korean supermarket.
Ooh.
And he was buying it because he wanted to make hot pot at the table, but jokingly said that this would be our Y2K solution because it was powered by cooking gas. But that's really the extent of my personal Y2K anecdotes. What I found really interesting as I was doing this research, and Margot came across some of this too, is that Y2K is still very much affecting us to this day, so much so that on January 1st, 2020, there were actually several computer systems that stopped working or got really glitchy because there were a lot of systems that put in that temporary fix I brought up earlier. So they had set themselves up to be good to go from, you know, that day all the way to 2020. And over time, people had kind of forgotten about this and didn't bother, you know, going back to fix it. And as a result, when the clock struck 12 on January 1st, 2020, you had a bunch of various systems that stopped working. Luckily, nothing that was, like, life-altering, but there was a couple of people who got utility bills that were dated with the year 1920. Lots of parking meters in New York City were declining credit card transactions because of this glitch. And WWE 2K20, the professional wrestling video game, stopped working at midnight on January 1st, 2020. And within 24 hours, they'd put a downloadable fix, but I thought that was kind of funny. The final one that, like, was ridiculous, I couldn't believe, was that Splunk, which is a software company here, and their kind of business is looking for errors in computer systems, ironically. They found a vulnerability that was going to affect them come January 1st, 2020. So they rolled out a fix to their users that later that week, which turns out the people who use Splunk include 92 of the Fortune 100 companies. So ultimately, while these people kind of messed up in this case, luckily not many people were impacted again. But it just goes to show, like, the common thread here being, oh, let's put in a quick fix to fix a long-term problem. Ultimately, today we are doing well. It's kind of funny to talk about Y2K. That's the other thing, really, that I thought was so interesting is, like, going back, remembering just how big of a deal this was. But ultimately now, it's just a pop culture joke. Like, people make the joke of, oh, yeah, Y2K, remember that, LOL? Like, I feel like we have forgotten just how much this took, you know, how much attention this took for so long.
I think some of it did kind of come up again as we were going from 2019 into 2020, yeah. As I said earlier, because some of the same fears resurfaced. Not to the same, I think that we've calmed down a little bit, probably because taking in the state of all things considered, it seems kind of quaint to be freaking out about, like, a computer glitch or...
Yeah.
I remember after the new year, seeing a bunch of articles being circulated about, like, don't write checks and abbreviate just 2020 or just write the 20 because somebody could just go in and write another year behind it and then cash a check years later. It's like, well, I think so much of people, is so much of people's attitudes now are like, you know, if they're going to do it, they're going to fucking do it. And versus before, when it was Y2K, people didn't know what was going to happen and, like, how could we even possibly fix it? But we have bigger problems than worrying about if somebody's going to forge a check and do some sort of long con check forging in 3 years and take out $100 from our account or whatever. I mean, a part of me is like, hope it's worth it. But this is also why things are FDIC insured. I just think that everybody has different priorities, and it's hard to stoke the fear about something this fixable.
Right. Yeah, at this point, again, like, back to what we were saying, there's just so many reinforcements have been put into place now that will solve the problem should anything like that happen, that we don't, need to worry about that. There are bigger fish to fry at this point.
Yeah, like, having way too many streaming services. Like, who thought that was going to be a problem?
Yeah.
But now this is the reality that we live in. But it was fun to revisit Y2K. It really is a bygone era.
Indeed. Indeed.
But so it is fun to see a lot of these, like, fashion trends kind of come back, like tiny sunglasses and trench coats and bike shorts. So much, like, translucent, because, like, remember, like, clear backpacks,
clear
plastic tops, like,
and, like, hair streaks, so, like, having, like, a metallic streak, you know, using hair mascara. That was another thing. I mean, it's a lot of what we were buying at Limited to in Delia's at that time. Very metallic-y, silvery, baby blue, icy, like, it was a little, like, in hindsight, almost like dystopian in some ways, like, in a metallic.
And now we do live in a dystopian future, exactly. So let's dress like it.
Let's dress like it, except let's not bring back those low-rise jeans. That's something that
bell-bottoms.
Or bell-bottoms.
Why?
Both things we can leave behind.
No, thank you.
Mm-mm.
Well, this was a fun jaunt back 20 years ago. We're old as dirt.
So old.
But you know what will keep you young? Subscribing to this podcast. That's wherever great. You listen, on iTunes, on Spotify. Well, I'm sorry, on Apple Podcasts, not iTunes. On Apple Podcasts, on SoundCloud, on Spotify. Although, heads up, I think we might be moving off of SoundCloud at some point. We will obviously give you a heads up if that's how you listen to us. But subscribe and rate and review us. You can find us on Instagram at The Old Millennials Pod.
You can also find us on Facebook at The Old Millennials Pod.
And you can find us individually on Twitter. I'm at Margs, she wrote.
And I'm at Emily A. Bejean.
And until next time, Happy New Year!
Happy New Year!
Bye!
Bye!